shores of El Pacifico. Bill Hendry.
Arizona has become the show me your paper state. And if I was a citizen of Arizona.
San Francisco is an island unto itself.
Middle school has always had drama and emotion, but the social networks amplify them.
I am gay.
World famous Phil Hendry show every night till 1 o'clock on the West Coast and 4 a.m. on the East Coast. The truth is our bitch kind of a thing here on a news talk and entertainment show that knows what it's talking about. And we take you through the looking glass and we give you the, you know, we give you the real scoop. And, of course, it's never what you think it is. Look at it. There's Paul Rodriguez on with Four Eyes. Now, Paul, I happen to know, is a raging fascist. I'm just kidding about that. But he's kind of a conservative, and he's on with Obermeister. How about that? Anyway, welcome to the program. Our number, 877-876-PHIL. We take a brief pause this evening for our crime night, and we do this once a month with the great Dr. Michael Stone, a forensic psychiatrist. He is on the teaching staff there at Columbia University in New York. And once a month, we bring on Dr. Stone, who's written such books as The Anatomy of Evil and has hosted Investigation Discovery's Most Evil show, to talk about crime, and specifically the crime of murder as it is committed by psychopaths and sociopaths and the mentally ill, you know, the schizophrenics. So he's going to be with us. Just extreme kinds of things like that. We're going to talk about this poor baby Phoebe Prince, the little girl from Ireland, driven to suicide by her first encounters in America. How wonderful. What a wonderfully proud moment for us, huh? A woman charged in the Hempstead Van Laan death. 18-year-old woman charged with vehicular manslaughter in the death of a Hempstead woman told her side of the story on Wednesday, and some of her comments are shocking. This in Hempstead, New York, April the 22nd is where that story is from. And then we'll talk with Dr. Stone as well about Francisco Acevedo. A man now accused of raping and strangling three women in a New York suburb started 21 years ago. 21 years ago, but was never even suspected until he submitted a DNA sample after a drunken driving arrest last year. This DNA, man.
Boy, you can't get away with nothing if you leave your DNA laying around.
Yeah, don't ever leave your DNA laying around, man.
Yeah, you don't leave it laying around, man. It's not going to be like a stain on your underwear or something.
Well, it's not a stain on your underwear.
If you don't wipe?
Well, you shut up. It's about DNA is in your blood and your saliva if you don't wipe. And that and other news coming up tonight on the Phil Hendry Show. Vernon Dozier is going to join us, and he is an educator from Glendale, California. They are, at his school at least, they are reintroducing home economics. Now, this was something that was taken off of the table, if you will. It was taken out of the curriculum at their school. I don't know if it's still taught in high schools, but home economics was something that, like my sister's generation, home economics. It's how you learn to, I don't know what they did. It was a mysterious class. If you were a boy, you didn't know what home economics was. I guess we thought it was cooking, but it's got to be something more than that. Anyway, they're thinking of bringing it back at Belmar Academy, and we'll be talking with him a little bit later on. And then more news on the Gulf oil spill. And it's gotten so bad. I woke up this morning to the news of that Gulf oil spill. It was there was an explosion, and they thought they had this thing well under control. They thought it was no more than 200 barrels. And today we find out that it could be worse than the Exxon Valdez. And, oh, by the way, the Exxon Valdez ain't anywhere near as bad as the top 10 oil spills of all time, which the Exxon Valdez, it don't even make the list. So I don't know, but nonetheless, this thing now is a blanket of oil out there in the Gulf. Somebody emailed me, a listener of ours, who lives on the Gulf Coast, and the email reads, "Thanks to BP, my surf fishing might come to a halt. I might Steve Bozell them and sue them. I got friends that work on some of the rigs down here, and they all say that BP, that's British Petroleum, has been cutting corners for years now, and it's caught up with them. I hope it's not true. If it is, something's hitting the fan." I don't know if that's true either. I don't know if it's true either. But that's just somebody writing me a piece of mail about British Petroleum. So, you know, last week I'm talking about 200 barrels of oil, and now this thing is. And the reason why I'm talking about this is because it couldn't have happened at a worse time. You know, the very first thing that I saw, our good, close personal friend Alan Combs after I asked him, how you doing with getting another chromosome? And anyway...
What's that mean?
Never mind. He said, hey, anybody for drilling, you know, anybody for a drill, baby, drill now? So in other words, oh, you're waiting around for a big fat oil spill, man, because now you can click your heels in joy, with joy and just say, we ain't drilling for no more oil because look what happens to the ducks. It just bothers the hell out of me. Forget it now. Forget it. There ain't going to be any more oil drilling. Forget it. It's done. It's done. They're going to find out why this thing happened and who did it and what did it and why is it and where is it and when is it and is it BP? Is it A&P? You know, was it TP? And they'll figure out it was a horrible convergence of ineffective technology and the big bad oil company. And let's just forget about drilling. Let's get right back on course now for wind power or whatever. It's a bummer, you know. But as long as we're going to stop drilling oil, I say they uncap a few of these out here in the Gulf, or out here in the Santa Barbara Channel, and just start flooding the coast and kill all those seals.
Not the baby seals, you kidding me?
I'm joking around, all right? 877-876-PHIL. Coming up, we have Dr. Michael Stone tonight on Crime Night, later on Vernon Dozier and the world-famous Phil Hendry Show, and then we're off for 2 weeks to the Grenadines, where we will be sending you, updating you every day, our video casts, video blogs. The world-famous Phil Hendry Show. Show, our number 877-876-PHIL, and we're online at philhenryshow.com, live streaming video of our show every night, as well as live streaming audio of the show, and we will have those video blogs and video casts for you from the Grenadines next week. And we bring on now Dr. Michael Stone from New York. Dr. Stone, world-renowned forensic psychiatrist, host of the Discovery ID show Most Evil, which is now available on DVD at Amazon.com. He's also the author of the book The Anatomy of Evil. Good evening, Dr. Stone. How are you, sir?
Fine, thank you.
Great. And how is the Broadway show going these days? Have you been out to see anything?
Well, we saw the opera. We saw La Traviata about a week ago, which was very nice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I'm not an opera guy, but I recognize that name. That's a famous opera. Who wrote that?
Verdi,
mm-hmm. Exactly. So... as a cultured man, you take your wife to the opera, and then you come home, and you dig into some of these things that are as bizarre as can be, Dr. Stone, and that's why we have you on the show here once a month to talk about this. And a lot of it's just flat sad, and tonight we're going to discuss, among other cases, this case of Phoebe Prince.
Yes.
And Phoebe Prince is the little girl people will remember who was bullied and taunted by envious girls in her class to the point where she hung herself. And some of these bully girls are now facing charges, as you point out in your notes. You, at the very beginning here, Dr. Stone, wrote the words, murder by proxy, ?
Uh-huh.
What do you mean by that?
Well, she killed herself, she hanged herself, after a particular taunt where one of the girls threw a bottle at her and called her an Irish whore.
Hmm.
And... she'd all endured a long period of mockery of that sort, humiliating remarks that were tossed at her. So if the girl in that situation, a young girl, you know, who's immature and typical adolescent who, like all adolescents, have not very much in the way of the kind of self-control that an older adult would have, you know, act in a very impulsive way, and then she went,
right.
Just couldn't take it anymore, and she hanged herself. But because she was really a fragile girl, and she was nudged in the direction of doing something like that, and these other people, you know, had pushed her in that direction, then in effect, they killed her. But of course, they didn't kill her in the same way that if they took a shotgun and, you know, shot her through their heart or the head. And in fact, it's the link is not as direct as it would be in a case of stabbing or shooting, because some other girl in a similar situation would have done any number of other things, not hanged yourself, gone to the authorities,
yeah.
complained to the principal, gone to a different school, but
yeah.
he was fragile.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, it's like in law, if you point a gun made out of licorice at an old lady who's got heart trouble and you say, you know, give me your money, this is a stick-up, but the gun is licorice and she doesn't know that, she thinks it's a real gun and she drops dead, then that's
yeah.
the fragile, that's the egg-like skull syndrome in law. In other words, the person is fragile, you've done something, you've made an assault, and they reacted in a very strong way and maybe even died, you're responsible. You're not maybe as responsible as if the gun was a real gun and you shot her, but you're still responsible under the law. So therefore, it's murder by in a substitute sort of a way.
Yeah. Hey, you know, Dr. Stone, when I heard this case, I thought back on one of the archetypal films of our era. In fact, it's... viewed as perhaps James Dean's greatest. It's, as I say, archetypal in terms of the post-World War II teen culture. But it also the film addresses directly what we're talking about right now, which is a boy played by James Dean who goes to this high school. And I'm talking about Rebel Without a Cause. He goes to a high school. He's bullied. He's taunted to the point where violence is the end result. A kid is killed. In fact, more than one kid is killed. The police have to talk this boy down from doing something worse. And so what I'm saying is, for 50 years at least, in our popular culture, we've recognized that kids at school get bullied, and it can become violent, and it can become tragic. And we're no closer to dealing with this problem today than we were in 1954, are we?
No, we're not. And of course, what you're pointing out... fits in with another truism, and that is that you take immature adolescents, you know, who have this proneness because of the brain not having a good braking system, if you will, and you push them too far. The boys will do something violent. The girls tend in the direction of depression and suicide. That doesn't mean there aren't any girls that kill, and there aren't any boys that commit suicide, because, of course, there are. But on average, boys are more prone to violence. Girls are more prone to depression and suicide. So it's not surprising that James Dean plays a boy that shoots, just like the ones in Littleton, Colorado, you know, Harris and Klebold, that spoke not being appreciated or being mocked by the other students, and they went ahead and took their guns and made a massacre. But poor Phoebe Prince hanged herself. So.
Except in the case of a James Dean or a Phoebe Prince, we see them as the reasonable kids who push too far.
Yes.
And Klebold and Harris were just sick, right? I mean, they were just accidents waiting to happen, those two guys.
Actually,
would you agree with that?
Mostly. Yeah. Klebold was more fragile. He was the follower. Harris was more sociopathic. You know, at and so he wasn't so much sick as he was sort of nasty, if you will. He went ahead and got his friend, you know, to accompany him, and that who was the more fragile one, and they blew all those students away. all of them.
So, you know, I was going to ask you, Dr. Stone, if you were advising, you know, since you and I have discussed and we've said, well, look, we can trace this at least a half a century, probably longer. I mean, just since half a century since we saw it on film with Rebel Without a Cause. But we've got kids getting bullied in schools. Now, if I were to come to you and say, we'll do whatever you say, Dr. Stone, how do we begin to solve the problem? What would you say? Is this about, and I've heard teachers say this is about recognizing when a kid's in trouble, knowing that when he means something, if he's going to be violent, does he mean it, or is he just acting out? Is he just being angry? Is this, we're going to take, we need smarter people teaching our kids, for starters.
Well, you know, I had a picture in my mind, sort of a fantasy auditorium where I would have the whole South Hadley school in the auditorium. Of course, you know, before there's a tragedy like a shooting or a hanging, it's hard to do that. But now that we know that something terrible happened, I think it would be very useful if some people from my mental health profession and some people from the teaching profession, got all those kids as a captive audience, listening, you know, to what the grown-ups were to say along the lines of, you know, you kids acted in an extremely nasty, hostile, immature way, and you should be bloody ashamed of yourself. Any one of you could mm-hmm. have been mocked by other people. It's unfair. It's shameful. It just gives a black mark on you, and look what it can sometimes lead to, the death of one of your own. And I'm, you'd want to have them all cry. You'd want to have them
yeah.
all wet from crying.
from tears, yeah, yeah.
And then right, maybe they case. Would be think, they may, maybe they'd think differently.
The healthy ones would, wouldn't they, Dr. Stone? But the sick ones, like the, well, not sick, but the twisted ones like the Eric Harris's, they would give you the big smile and say, gee, Dr. Stone, thank you. That's so, I'm going to take that to heart and then go home and play with their guns, wouldn't they?
Yes, some of them would, but yeah. don't forget, a lot of the ones who were, there were some boys that mocked this Phoebe Prince, too, but a lot of them were girls. And the interesting thing is, the girls, there's pictures of them in the, you can get from Google. One of them was unattractive, one of them was average-looking, and one of them was pretty. You mm-hmm. can easily picture that the unattractive one would be jealous because Phoebe Prince was very pretty. The
right.
Average one could also be kind of jealous. And the pretty one, even she could be jealous if it so happened that the boyfriend that she had began to ditch her and show his attentions on Phoebe because...
Was attracted to Phoebe, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, because even two pretty girls of equal beauty, one could be very sweet, as probably Phoebe Prince was, and the other might be kind of abrasive or have a bit of a mouth, in which case the boy yeah. would gravitate toward the sweet one, and then the girl that was ditched would get very angry, even though she's, you know, attractive.
I want to ask you about bullies. I want to ask you about bullies, Dr. Stone. Are they sociopathic? Are they, I imagine they just, they probably run the gamut. Are they bullied at home? Are they physically abused at home? What is it with these kids?
There's really no one size fits all, Phil, because there are some bullies who absolutely are sociopathic, especially the boys. I remember, and they usually begin to surface at age 8. The bully boy at mm-hmm. 8 is usually in trouble with the law by 28. There's sort of a maxim in my profession. But there are other bullies who, especially in groups, where none of them are particularly wicked in general, but there's a newcomer or there's somebody of a different religion, a different race, a different country, whatever, who seems shy or seems funny-looking. There's any number of reasons why the group may pick on a particular kid, or in the workplace that the employees may, or the bosses may pick on a particular person in the company. And then you can't say that all of those people in the group are all crazy or sick. They're kind of average people that maybe have a faulty moral compass, shall we say, and they're
yeah,
willing
yeah.
to join in to bad behaviors, not all being really evil people, but and when there's a group, you know, each one can point the finger at the other and say, well, I went along, I really kind of feel bad about it, but the one who really was the responsible was that other guy or that other girl.
Well, you know, and we're going to take a break here, Doc, but it brings to mind a story I read last week about two guys that tortured to death two hamsters and then put it on YouTube. Now, it's one thing to be weird and sick and twisted and just maniacal like that. It's another thing to be so disconnected and perhaps stupid that you put it on YouTube thinking what? People are going to dig it? They're going to think that you're wow, you know.
Yeah.
What is that? You know. And then when they find out that people are disgusted by it, then they start pointing fingers at each other like, well, I really didn't mean it.
Right.
Weird.
Yeah.
Very weird. Doc, when we come back, we're going to talk about the Hempstead Van Lawn death. This is an 18-year-old woman charged with vehicular manslaughter and the death of a Hempstead, New York woman.
Right.
She has spoken out. She claims she was high on painkillers when she drove a van onto the front lawn and into the house of homeowner Rebecca Twine Wright, age 69, who was mowing her lawn at the time.
Yes.
We're going to find out what this girl's problem was, and we've got some other very extreme serial killer, perhaps one serial killer has been uncovered in some of these cases that we have with Dr. Stone this evening. We're talking to Dr. Michael Stone, you guys. Dr. Stone, as you know, a forensic psychiatrist, host of Most Evil on Investigation Discovery. You can still see Most Evil on the schedule there, and as well, the author of The Anatomy of Evil. And we're going to be back with more in just a moment. World-famous Phil Hendry Show. Our number is 877-876-PHIL, and we're online at philhendryshow.com with live streaming video and audio right now.
Phil Hendry.
Welcome back here. It is Crime Night here on the Phil Hendry Show with Dr. Michael Stone from Columbia University and The Anatomy of Evil, available now at Amazon.com. Great book written by Dr. Stone about evil and what prompts people to become evil and to commit these terrible crimes like murder. Dr. Stone, when we left off, we were talking about this story from this month, April of 2010. An 18-year-old woman has been charged with vehicular manslaughter. Now, she is high on painkillers. She has a van. She drives onto the front lawn and then into the house of a woman named Rebecca Twine Wright, who's mowing her lawn, and she kills this woman. Before her arraignment, she was, quote, emotional and said, "I didn't mean to do it. The car went out of control. I was pressing the brake. It was all a mistake." However, later, she is quoted as saying, and this was around Wednesday, 16 hours after the accident, in a statement to police, "The thing that made me feel not so bad was she was old. I mean, 70 years is a long time to live." So this is this girl, Kayla Gerdes. Yeah, this is the girl's name is Kayla Gerdes. She claims she was high on pills, but, I mean, there's something going on with this woman's conscience, isn't there?
Yes. Well, it's probably a Swiss cheese conscience, I should imagine. This is one of those domino things. I'm a medical director in a drug and alcohol addiction clinic, so I see a lot of these youngsters. And what you have in these kind of situations, I don't know anything about her background, but my guess is there's something not quite right about the family. Let's say the family's split, or this troubled family in some way, even if the parents are together, or there are other addicted or alcohol-dependent or drug-abusing people in the family, something that sets her up to be troubled adolescent and to resort to drugs in order to self-medicate and self-soothe. She goes on OxyContin, you know, an opiate, and an anti-anxiety pill, Xanax. And she's then, in order to support the habit, see, these young kids, especially the girls, they can sell their bodies, well, part of their body, that they can have a boyfriend that, you know, is a dealer or helps support them, or they can shoplift. Now, having shoplifted, she was trying to get to court. And because she's high on all these drugs, I'm sure she was... she was late for court. She wanted to make sure she got there on time. So when the guy that she was with wasn't driving fast enough, she said, "Well, let me drive." And then she drives very fast, but she doesn't know what the hell she's doing, you know, on all those drugs. So she makes a wrong turn and plows into that poor lady and also into the practically smashing the house. And now that the Toyota, you know, has been accused of this problem with the, you know, the accelerator. She says, you know, "I had my foot on the brake, but it didn't work." Yeah, right. And Albert Schweitzer is my uncle. poor excuse. And then the next day, I'm sure she didn't mean to kill the woman. Of course not. But she put herself in a position where the likelihood, the risk of a tragedy occurring, either to herself, the person in the next seat, or this stranger, was sky high. And therefore, she's responsible. She's not responsible as if she took a gun and shot her, but she's responsible.
Now, what prompts her to make the statement, "Well, you know, she's 70, that's a long time left"? That's strange. I mean, that's just a strange thing to say. No matter how stoned you are, that's a very weird thing to say, I think. Don't you?
Yes, it is. It's obviously it's something she's saying as if to make her feel a little bit less guilty, you know, like take 8% of her guilt off. but it's so incredibly unfeeling. Granted that many young people think that 70 is, you know, an extraordinary age, you know, like
maybe you're right.
The asteroids would come first and obliterate, you know, the whole race before
right, right.
You'd reach 70. But it's an extraordinary unfeeling thing to say, and I would like to think that, you know, even most girls and boys her age would have a little bit more sentiment and also restraint of the mouth not to say something as ugly as that. You know?
Well, that brings me to this question then, because I would think that a young person who's healthy would maybe years from now make a joke somewhere in that direction, but at the time of the death, it would never occur to them. So we're all aspiring to be in our own minds Dr. Michael Stones when we sit and reread our newspapers and we watch the news and we'll say, aha, this is a sociopath here, this is a psychopath here, you know, because we're learning so much more with the information that we have. But so now I find myself tempted, Dr. Stoney, you can tell me, that when I hear somebody say something like that, or these two guys with the hamsters, that I immediately start thinking of this state of mind where there's no conscience, that sometimes is called psychopath, sometimes is called sociopath. Is it a lot more prevalent than we've ever been led to believe?
I have a hunch you're onto something, actually. Because when I was thinking, when I was in college, which is... It seems like 70 years ago. It was a little bit.
Yeah,
less.
There you go. Yeah, yeah. Before the asteroids. Yeah.
We had alcohol. There were two. There was a boy and a girl. Well, I mean, they were in their 20s. That came from Paris. You know, that they were Americans that studied abroad for a while, and then they came onto Cornell, where I went to university, and they were alleged to have tried marijuana. None of us knew what it was.
Yeah.
and that was it. The campus had 10,000 people. There were certainly a number of kids that got drunk in the fraternities and so on, but there was no one heard of cocaine, no one heard of marijuana. Come Timothy Leary in the 60s and starting of the drug revolution in the last 50 years, there's a hell of a lot more young people who abuse these things. And so they some of them therefore end up stealing and prostituting themselves, holding up people, mugging and so on, in order to get the money, you know, for drugs. So the people that wouldn't have necessarily gone bad had they not had all this stuff available and had there not been the culture that is so now laden, you know, with drugs, drug paraphernalia, people trying to legitimize the use of marijuana in California, granted, you know, for certain kinds of sick people, but you know it's going to happen. So there's a lot more young people that are tempted by these things and who go bad, who wouldn't have in my generation. So it's a very sad spectrum.
Are you, Dr. Stone, are you saying that the use of these drugs causes a sociopathic mind to
I wouldn't say
develop?
I would say, first of all, the ones who are in the sociopathic direction are very prone to abusing drugs. In other words, callous, emotional young people, you know, who are bullies, young girls that are kind of loose angry, whatever. Adolescents who are troubled tend to abuse drugs in this generation more than the adolescents who are not troubled. So, but then once you start abusing the drugs, then you start a vicious circle because now you're doing something which dampens conscience all the more because you're craving the drug, especially if it's cocaine, marijuana, or meth.
Yeah.
Now you're taken over by the drug, and now you're going to do anything to get the drug. So now your behavior is taking a turn in the direction of this sociopathy, even if you're not a stone cold sociopath or psychopath,
yeah.
But you're nudging in that direction. So this girl, Gayla Gurdas, was behaving antisocially. She shoplifted. That's a crime. And then, of course, it ended up in this vehicular manslaughter.
Yeah.
But she was already doing antisocial things. And if she didn't have it all available, and she still came from a troubled family, and she was sad and lonely and blah, 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 she would have done something else that was not criminal and not high risk that she could end up killing somebody.
But had there been no drugs in her life, she still would be on some level, she would have this impaired or conscience, or this Swiss cheese conscience that you were talking about.
But,
correct.
But the holes. But not as. The holes might have been littler, Phil.
Gotcha. See, yeah, no, I hear you. Okay.
The temptation and the need, you know, to do whatever she could to get the stuff would not be there, and so that she might be just, you know, a girl with somewhat amoral, and not
right.
fully, and not really doing anything particularly bad. Just she might have been lonely and sad, and maybe she would have even gotten some psychiatric help instead.
Yeah, I hear you.
Off in this other direction.
Of course, there is no psychiatric treatment for psychopathy, is there?
Not
really.
Not for the full-blown psychopathy, yeah. But I don't think that she was probably a full-blown. I wouldn't peg her as a full-blown psychopath.
Yeah. Dr. Stone, we're going to take a break. I wanted to tell our audience, though, this next case we're going to talk with Dr. Stone about is Francisco Acevedo, I believe is his name. And he's accused of raping and strangling three women in a New York suburb starting 21 years ago. But was never even suspected until he submitted a DNA sample after a drunk driving arrest last year. So we will find out once again how DNA figures so prominently in the solving of these crimes that up to, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago, huh, Doc, that were just unsolvable. But
yeah, 85 was revolution... the first one in England that got solved by DNA.
So 85?
Yeah.
85. Okay. We'll be back. We'll be talking to Dr. Michael Stone about that and a few other things as we continue here on Crime Night with Dr. Michael Stone and a world-famous Phil Hendry Show.
It's the Phil Hendry Show.
World-famous Phil Hendry Show. Welcome back. And Dr. Michael Stone joining us for our final segment here on Crime Night. We usually have these on Friday nights, but I'm off tomorrow as we travel to the Caribbean for a couple of weeks. And we will have our regular video blog updates for you there. Dr. Stone has been talking with us this hour. We've kind of been all over the place, but we started with the poor girl Phoebe Prince and this idea of bullying and really, what does that represent, psychopathy, or is it the kids themselves who are bullied at home? And we've moved on to the use of drugs and sociopaths. Now we have this man, Dr. Stone, is a serial rapist, identified by DNA that he gave after a drunk driving arrest. Investigators had looked at, they said, 100 other potential suspects over the years before they found the blood sample from this man, Francisco Acevedo. It matched DNA evidence from these killings. The strangling of these women in Yonkers, New York, and this according to the Yonkers detective. So this DNA is just astounding. I mean, what do you know about DNA evidence, Dr. Stone? What are its limits? Are there any? I mean, it seems like it's just the sky's the limit with this.
Well, the limits, I suppose, would be if you have such a tiny sample as with fingerprinting, you know, that the number of overlaps with the suspect and the DNA sample are point in the direction of, but are not quite convincing. However, now that they're able, you know, to put the small samples in special solutions and multiply the number of these chemical bonds, et cetera, so they can get a larger amount, they can usually get a very good reading, and then they can check that the DNA really is a very good match. And when it's a match, usually the odds are in the billions or quadrillions, which effectively means he's our guy. You know, the likelihood of finding somebody else on Earth who has the same series of bands is it's essentially zero. But in law, you have to say that it's vanishingly small. And the first time, as I say, that somebody was nailed by DNA was this fellow Colin Pitchfork. It's a funny last name.
God, no kidding.
In the Midlands of England, there were two dead girls two girls were raped and killed in there in a short time, and they, the constables and the police, felt that it was a guy that was probably from that area. So they had 5,000 men give blood samples, and none of them matched. But there was one guy that said, "Oh, I'm, you know, I'm kind of afraid. I just get scared. I faint at the sight of blood." So he told his friend, "Can you, you know, give a blood sample for me? And because I'm just scared to give blood." So he went along with that. But then he had what James Joyce called an agon bite of inwit, a pang of conscience. He said, "Gee whiz!" And so he told the police, "You know, maybe we better, maybe you better, you know, look at this guy, Colin Pitchfork." And of course, it matched, and he was you know, convicted, and of course in prison. That was the first triumph of DNA back in '85.
DNA, and this was the police decided to use this because it just happened to be available to them, because the lab was it. You know, where do you and how do you decide? Hey, let's use this DNA technology that I understand has been developed, and there's a lab that's really close by, and we can get these tests done. How long did it take to get these tests back, by the way?
They can sometimes be done inside of a week, but, of course, now many of the labs around the country that do them, you know, they have backups, and sometimes it takes months and even more, depending upon the urgency of the case. I was involved with one person that I know who was... almost killed. He was his wife attempted to murder him. And she was also considered a suspect in another murder that happened a little bit before that. She was already in prison for the attempted murder of the person that I knew. She was a suspect in the other murder, and she gave her blood. She had him in the prison. But they kept it on the back burner, because she was already in jail, so what the heck? So it took really a couple of years before they finally got around, you know, to testing some of the blood spatter from this female victim from a different town, et cetera, against the woman who was in prison, her blood, and it was a match. Now, they just dawdled, you know, because the woman was already in prison, so she was no longer a risk to the community. But obviously, it was a very sad thing for the parents of the dead woman to be kept in suspense for such a long time. But they're going to go after somebody who's at large more quickly than they will. They'll do those tests in a matter of a couple of weeks or even shorter. Rather than somebody who's already in prison. But this guy, Acevedo, was trying to get on parole for a minor offense, a drunk driving, and that entitled the police to get a swab from him. But then, of course, by golly, it matched the blood from these three women that he strangled in the early 90s.
Why did the police test this guy, this drunk driving guy? Why did they suspect him for these murders?
I think he lived. I think it had to do with geography. I think he was known to live in the area, and the women were in the Bronx area in Lower Westchester, and he may have had some other offenses. I don't know his whole rap sheet. He was, you know, in a small circle of a few hundred possibles, as you might say.
Sure.
And so they were able to concentrate on it.
When I think of DNA, I always think of my kids. I came into the kitchen one morning, Dr. Stone, and they were wandering around like zombies, holding bowls of oatmeal that had not yet been cooked. And I realized the microwave was broken. And they didn't get, like, almost like Stone Age natives, they didn't know what tool to use because the microwaves broke. And I don't imagine our police are like that. But I always think, whatever happens if the DNA thing, you know, for whatever reason, you know, we can't use it anymore. These guys are going to have to go back to doing detective work. In other words, are cops maybe losing their edge a little bit with this?
Well, I think there's always, with criminals, there's always an arms race. In other words, once fingerprints are shown to be essentially foolproof, if you have a good print, you know, that has enough overlap that 9 or 10 or 15 points of similarity, then they'll wear gloves. And they may even, I mean, a very sophisticated criminal might do something like kill somebody and try to graft that person's, you know, finger prints, his skin, onto their fingers so that they end up being somebody else. Well, as far as DNA, I'll give you a story if we have a moment. Phil Skipper down in Louisiana lived near the Mississippi border, just a total psychopath. I mean, this is 100% psychopath.
Oh, God.
Lived next
you got 40 seconds, doctor.
Okay. He lived next to a black woman who was a well-to-do and nice woman and was helping out his family. And what he did was, these are this white trash kind of people, he killed a woman, and then he held up a black guy at gunpoint, forced him to masturbate into a cup, spread the sperm over the woman, making the police think that it was a black man rather than a white man, and so Phil Skipper was not caught for a couple of years because of having duped the police in that way.
Oh, boy. You're right. It's an arms race or some other kind of race, which I won't mention. Dr. Stone, thank you. See you next month. Dr. Michael Stone.
Bill Hendricks.